apartments and labyrinthine complexes. We consumers are the product and the suppliers of lifeblood capital to those daylight vampires that never get enough. Not only polluted air, but polluted airwaves. We're poisoned by the media we know we're ingesting, and by every other message only our cell walls can hear, unable to not eventually surrender. Even if everyone in the country had voted for Trump, he'd still not give a damn about us. Maybe the biggest profit makers will care about us once we start dying off and can no longer buy anything. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
That was KBOO News reporter Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 18th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem, Dave Johnson, Dan Raphael, and Althea Billings. The producer is Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Zamon Perez, Antonia Gonzalez, Isabel Charlet, and Dan Kroll. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Dave Johnson.
I'm Terrence Burns. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text to KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Hannah Francis. Today we are discussing the article by Jake Thomas titled "Clawed Back." Oregon lawmakers are considering a bill that would codify how prison officials can haul people back behind bars if they may have been released in error. Critics say it would enshrine overreach. I have here with me Street Roots reporter Jake Thomas. Hi, Jake. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So first, can you tell me about how someone could be released in error?
So it is a pretty rare thing for someone to be released from prison in error. But what's really extraordinary about the situation facing the state of Oregon is the fallout from this court ruling, this Oregon Supreme Court ruling from last year that's known as the Torres-Lopez ruling. This case centers the Torres-Lopez ruling. It's centered on a man, Abraham Torres-Lopez, who's arrested for on charges of identity theft and fleeing an officer. And before he went to prison, he spent some time in Marion and Clackamas County jails. And when he was finally sentenced, his sentencing court gave him 125 days for time served, but he ended up only getting 85. And that's because of the way that the sentencing court calculated his time in different prisons, in different jail systems in Clackamas and Marion County. And so what the Torres-Lopez ruling meant was that people who are entitled to more time served, and that a lot of sentences that people are not getting enough time served in county jails previously. And the whole thing is super complicated about how that gets calculated. It's not just a matter of counting up the days. It involves legal interpretations. But broadly, it just meant that their sentences should be shortened because they had already served part of it in county jail, is the idea. And so when this ruling came out, it was kind of obscure. People didn't really talk about it. But what the Department of Corrections was doing after the ruling is they started recalculating sentences to comply with the Torres-Lopez ruling. And so some prisoners, about little like under 400 or so, they had their sentences recalculated. And people were said, you can go. We miscalculated it. We changed your calculation. You're free to go. And so what happened after that was there was backlash to it. And there was prosecutors start saying there were some people who were convicted of some pretty serious crimes who had their sentences reduced by quite a bit. There was also another subsequent Supreme Court ruling that sort of clarified the situation. And so what happened was that the Department of Corrections said, nope, we're going to recalculate this again. You need to come back. And they did this to 22 people who are told to come back and serve more time of their sentence.
So there were these 22 instances of people being brought back, but you give some specific examples of two people's experiences after being released and then called back again. The first one is Natalia Hernandez. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me a little bit about her story? What happened when she was released early and now being called back, how that's affected her?
Yeah, so it was, she told her story, she in legislative testimony and in court filings. And what happened was with her is that she ended up doing a prison sentence at Coffee Creek. She was, it was drug related, and she was in an alternative incarceration program, which, you know, offers rehabilitation. And she's in the middle of that program. And just all of a sudden, out of the blue last year in August, she has an officer say, you're getting out today. And she is shocked by this. And she, what I thought was really notable is that she said in court filings and in her testimonies that she didn't want to leave. She wanted to stay. She wanted to complete the program. She wasn't ready. Like she was going to be released that day. She didn't have anything lined up for housing or even a ride or anything. So she is released. She really doesn't want to go back to prison. She sounds like she's trying to get her life together. She leaves Salem. She gets into sober housing, finds a manufacturing job, is doing treatment, gets married, and is pregnant. But then all of a sudden, she was vacationing with her husband in Lincoln City when she got a call from the sheriff's office saying that they had come to arrest her. And this was last year. It was totally out of the blue. And she goes back, she turns herself in, and she's spends some more time in jail, or prison rather.
And so now she's back in prison and she's pregnant. Control. What's her situation now?
Well, she got reincarcerated. So there's a group, the Oregon Justice Resource Center, which is a nonprofit law firm that does a lot of criminal justice issues. So they filed a habeas petition with the Oregon Supreme Court. And the petition basically argued that the Department of Corrections does not have legal authority to do this, that she was labeled an escapee, which is, it seems bizarre. The Department of Corrections, they explained that this is just a legalese term, a technical term, saying that if somebody's released, they're considered an escape. Even though they didn't actually escape, but that's just what they're considered for legal purposes. But anyways, the Oregon Justice Resource Center in this petition, they argue that the department can't do this and that she should be released immediately. And part of their argument was that this happened without any kind of due process or hearing, because it's one of the fundamental principles of the legal system is that if you're going to have your freedom taken away and you're going to be put in prison, you need to have your day in court. You need to be able to give your side, and you have a chance to make your case. And her petition argued that she didn't have that. She didn't have that. So it's pretty extraordinary. 10 people of the 22 who are reincarcerated have been released under habeas petitions. And so they've been released, but it's still been a very jarring experience for them, because what's happened for a lot of people just across the board with prosecutors and victims and people who have been reincarcerated, they at one point thought that the criminal justice system, the courts, were giving them a sense of finality to a really horrible ordeal, that they just want to kind of, and every, you know, they had the court had its sentencing and everybody thought that they could just get through whatever is happening and get on with their lives. But that's just been kind of upended. And now these people and their families, they don't know what's going to happen. They've already been reincarcerated out of the blue, and it's all just become a little unpredictable for them.
So you gave another example of someone who was called back into prison. What happened to him? What's his story?
So another story that I found in my reporting was, so Michael McEwen, he was, years ago, he was in Southern Oregon in the like kind of Medford Central Point area. And he walks into a bar in Central Point and he demands money out of the till. The person working the bar refused. And so he puts his finger in his pocket and he pretends he has a gun and says, "Give me the money." The employee says no, and she gets other customers to subdue him. And later in an affidavit by the police officer who arrested him, the officer describes how he was sorry about what he did, that he had a fentanyl habit he was trying to support, and he regretted what he did. And he was a first-time offender, so he gets sentenced to prison. He gets into a the alternative incarceration program, which has rehabilitation. And he's in the middle of that program as well when he gets released. And so according to his defense attorney who spoke at the legislative hearing, he's released. He moves to the Boise area where he has family. He gets married. He becomes a father. He's in rehabilitation. He's working. And this, I wasn't able to speak with him, but this is just according to what I've learned about him. So he's also sounds from the accounts I've heard that he's trying to do the right thing and get his life back together. And then he gets a phone call from his probation officer saying, "You need to come in." And so he was arrested and then he was also sent back to prison. But he was also, he was one of those with the petition who had a petition for the Supreme Court that got him released.
So he's now released again, but now things are all shaken up.
They've been shaken up. Well, what's really caused a lot of uncertainty with all this is so I think it's widely acknowledged that the fallout from the Torres Lopez ruling has just been a mess. So there is legislation currently before lawmakers that's aimed at the Torres Lopez ruling and trying to clean it up. And so part of what this legislation seeks to do is it would clarify, it addresses a complaint from prosecutors that people were getting released from prison early, a lot earlier than what their sentence called for. That is basically saying that what's happened is that people get sentenced to a term that's supposed to reflect the severity of their crime that's been negotiated maybe with a defense lawyer. And they say that's all gone out the window, that just these prison sentences don't mean anything. And by the way that the Department of Corrections has interpreted the ruling, and they just want to clarify, have a mechanism to clarify just what these sentences mean. And also what's probably more controversial about this legislation is that it would create a legal process for the Department of Corrections to reincarcerate somebody who's been released because of a bad legal interpretation of a sentence or because their sentence was miscalculated. During the testimony on the bill with the Marion County deputy prosecuting attorney or deputy district attorney, he was saying that this would actually help defend. It would be good for defendants because they'd get their day in court and the process would probably help them. But there you have these people who've been released, and it would apply to not just these 22 people, but possibly more. Where it just establishes this process for the Department of Corrections or a prosecutor to initiate a process for to haul somebody back and reincarcerate them. And the Oregon Justice Resource Center, and some other critics of it, there's some defense attorneys, they've been very critical of this. They said that this is just really giving the state too much power, that this is executive overreach, that this really undermines people's rights in a really serious way.
So they're saying that enshrining the ability to bring people back to prison in law is like a step too far and that we just shouldn't do that, period.
Period. Yeah, I talked to Bobin Singh, who's the executive director of the Oregon Justice Resource Center. And he said he likened this to the state, a lot of state leaders criticize the Trump administration for, having these sweeping executive actions that seem to violate people's rights, that just end up, you know, where they have these immigration sweeps that just lock people up without any due process, and then they're in legal limbo and they get released, and then who knows what's going to happen. And they're saying that the, you know, state leaders are criticizing this and saying that and challenging this, but then we have this process here in Oregon that's also violated people's rights, and that this legislation would just enshrine that, would just give prosecutors and state authorities just this process to haul people back to jail whenever they want. So the critics of this law really argue that it's ripe for the potential of for abuse, that a prosecutor could use it to target somebody. And this is just going to lead to more litigation, is what, mm-hmm. what critics argue.
So do these critics have like an alternative solution to address this?
So the critics of the bill, they say that this should not be happening in the short session, which happens every other year in the even numbered years. The short session is 35 days, and it's supposed to be for like just legislative fixes and just legislation that doesn't require a lot of heavy lifting. But every year you see some major policy bill that, you know, is in the legislature, and this criticism gets rolled out. And so what some critics of this bill are saying is that the short session is not the time to do this, that you just really need more time to do it. And so they're proposing what happens to a lot of legislation or controversial legislation is it gets shelved, and then some sort of work group gets formed in between sessions, which, you know, could include just everyone who's has an interest in the bill or the issue that it's aimed at. And then they'll come up with some sort of compromise, hopefully. And then by the long session, they'll come back with a solution. The lawmakers will have 6 months during the long session to work on it. And so that's what they're saying, is that this is not a short session issue to be doing something this consequential.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks.
Of course.
You've been listening to an interview with Street Roots reporter Jake Thomas about his recent article titled "Clawed Back: Oregon Lawmakers Are Considering a Bill That Would Codify How Prison Officials Can Haul People Back Behind Bars If They May Have Been Released in Error. Critics say it would enshrine overreach." For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Hannah Francis.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Dave Johnson. The Copernicus Climate Change Service has recently come out with a report that summarizes the year 2025. To get a sense of what's in that report, KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Atiya Jafar, the 350.org Canada Country Manager.
2025 has just passed us. What can you tell us about that year in terms of climate change?
Yeah, 2025 was a very sobering year. It was the third hottest year on record, which made it the first time that in a three-year period that as a globe we've exceeded the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit that we were trying to achieve in the Paris Climate Agreement. Air temperature over global land areas was second warmest, while the Antarctic saw its warmest annual temperature on record. It was devastating in so many different ways. We know that, you know, in Canada, where I live, there was an unprecedented wildfire season. I mean, it was the second worst wildfire season in Canadian history. More than 6,000 wildfires in every province and territory, impacting over 8.3 million hectares that burned during that time.
Wow. And other countries were also affected by wildfires?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm just thinking about right now, even just the 1 year mark of the LA wildfires that were also happening, you know, this time last year. And yeah, not just wildfires, cyclones, drought, extreme rainfall. It resulted in a collective economic loss of $120 billion. The LA wildfires were the costliest, with $60 billion in damages. And just 2 weeks into 2026, we're seeing the same trend. Unfortunately, it's devastating. We're seeing wildfires ravage parts of Australia, Argentina, and South Africa. There's a severe snowstorm that has come into Europe. So yeah, it was a devastating year, and we're seeing the devastation continue, unfortunately.
And we've been hearing for a long time about this 1.5 heating threshold. And meanwhile, we have an administration in the U.S. that seems to be going the opposite direction. What would you say about that? How much does that affect what's going on in the world?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important to recognize that 1.5 degrees Celsius was a really important number that we landed in the Paris Climate Agreement. And we are coming dangerously close to crossing that really, really critical line, a line that means life or death, because every fraction of a degree of heating means, every fraction of a degree of heating means more lives are lost, more ecosystems are damaged, and more communities are facing irreversible harm. So it's really, really important to prevent surpassing that 1.5 degree threshold. And what we're seeing just with the withdrawal of the United States and the direction that the US government, but also other governments are taking, it's the absolute wrong direction. It's something that our climate can't afford. And it is isolating these governments from our future, the future that we know we deserve. We know we need to transition away from fossil fuels. We know that's something that even the, even if you look at the economic trends, you can see they're more favorable towards renewable energy. The world is collectively moving away from this toxic source of energy that is poisoning our climate and that is making the planet unlivable for so many people. Yeah, it's really disappointing to see, and we must move in the right direction.
So it sounds like you're saying that the people like Trump who say drill, baby, drill, and more oil, they're going against a historical trend and eventually they'll be defeated, or will it go the other way where the planet will be destroyed?
Yeah, I think we are at a pretty critical fork in the road. You know what I mean? I think there's a lot of different directions that we can go in. And it's very clear what science it has told us. Science has told us that in order to secure a livable future for everyone, to ensure that we're avoiding the most devastating outcomes of the climate emergency, we must phase out fossil fuels. And it's really up to us to make sure that we go in this direction. I think it's up to people power, people across the world to rise up and send a really clear message for what we want. Because I would like to believe that the US is isolated in the direction that they're going, but we are seeing really troubling trends across the world. We're seeing kind of like a permission that has been given to world governments as a result of Trump's actions. Even in Canada, now there are pipeline projects that are back on the table that weren't even, that were defeated a long time ago. There was no world in which they were considered conceivable at this stage in our fight against a climate emergency, but they're back on the table now. So we're seeing these really damaging trends, and it's up to us to rise up and fight back and ensure that that's not the direction that we go in. It's really important to ensure that we're fighting for a renewable energy future. And we know that this is not a partisan issue. I come from Pakistan, and Pakistan is leading the way with solar energy, and it has nothing to do with politics. It just has to do with the fact that it is a cheap, affordable form of electricity that is allowing people to have more energy security, and it's ensuring that the planet isn't, polluted as a result. Like, people are seeing immediate impacts, immediate positive impacts in their life from solar energy. It's not like a right versus left issue. And I think what we have to do is ensure that we are moving forward in this collective direction globally as well, that we're realizing that renewables hold a lot of benefits for our future, but also for our immediate present. The numbers speak for themselves, and it's really important to ensure that we can actually preserve that.
I do recall a time when it wasn't so much a political issue. I mean, if you go back to, say, the early 90s, George Bush, the first Bush, was president, and he talked about the dangers of climate change. But since then, it really has become almost a cultural issue among conservatives that this thing is a hoax, and we don't need to worry about it, and our technology can solve it. So, I mean, in a real politic way, it is a political issue.
Yes. Yeah, it's absolutely a political issue in many countries, including the US and Canada. And that's a result of the power of the fossil fuel industry, right? It's the power of big oil to have a really strong hold on our politicians and our governments, which is extremely, extremely troubling, because we know, regardless of your political stripes, none of us benefit when big oil and fossil fuel companies get richer. The wealth of the and power of the fossil fuel industry is something that we must fight back against. And it's something that is resulting in loss for the rest of us. So it's really important to recognize that, and it's really important to recognize that we cannot have fossil fuel companies, some of the richest companies on Earth, making decisions about our future and having such a stronghold on our politicians. So cutting this tie that big oil has over our politics is extremely important, because you're right, it's making this life or death issue, which is truly nonpartisan in every way, because everyone is impacted by the climate emergency, it's turned it into a political issue. And that's something that's really important to fight back against. And it's really important to fight back against, you know, at every level, whether it's having conversations at our dinner table with people that we might not necessarily agree with, but that we're connected to. It's about ensuring that we are holding all politicians to account. And it's also ensuring that we're like drawing visibility to all the ways in which the fossil fuel company has access to our politicians, to the halls where decisions are made.
Do you know how much of the world's oil production the U.S. is impacting?
That's a really good question.
And what it would mean if the U.S. went in the more ecological direction?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have all the numbers in front of me right now, but we know that the U.S. obviously has access to massive carbon reserves. And beyond that, the U.S. is, of course, extending its influence now over oil reserves outside of their political borders as well. And that is very dangerous. And it goes to show that, you know, it is very instrumental for the United States to move in line with the rest of the world. But we also know that the rest of the world cannot wait for the U.S. to catch up, because the climate emergency is at our doorstep. Even if the U.S. is stepping away from the Paris Climate Agreement, the climate emergency is not just simply pausing. You know, we must act in response. And I think that's the most important thing. In Canada, for example, we are pushing our politicians not to let Trump or the U.S. determine what our energy or climate policies should be. We should be rising up and ensuring that we're acting in line with science, and that is something that the entire world should be doing. So there's an important role for powerful countries to play, but also if one of the powerful countries is not playing ball, that doesn't mean that the rest of the world stops. And if we are changing the world's relationship to oil, which, you know, a lot of countries have already implemented that transition, then that is kind of further isolating these bad actors that are not moving in line with science.
And what about the good actors? You mentioned Pakistan. What other countries are pursuing what would you call it, a soft energy path and trying to eliminate the use of fossil fuels?
Yes, that's a great question. I mean, I know that we are seeing global uptake in renewable energy. We know that, you know, countries like Nepal, Norway, we are seeing China lead. And these are, you know, China is a major global economic actor. There's huge potential for renewable energy to take hold. And there are just like, you know, like there's so much potential across the world. In Canada, we are seeing renewable energy really, it has expanded vastly. And a lot of the leaders in Canada are also Indigenous communities as well. Indigenous communities are leading the way to the transition. We're seeing such huge leadership when it comes to owning and developing renewable energy technology within Indigenous communities. So a lot of the leadership is there. We're seeing the potential of community-owned renewable energy projects, whether it's Indigenous-owned or owned by various different communities across the world. And people are seeing the immediate impact. We know that renewable energy also creates more jobs than the fossil fuel sector. We're seeing that renewable energy also leads to immediate impacts. Like we talked about, like, for example, in Pakistan, I was talking about how people are just immediately seeing the impact on their energy bills. They know that it's cheaper. They know that it disconnects them through to these unstable systems where they don't know whether or not they're going to have access to electricity. Renewable energy is creating energy security. And also we are seeing that renewable energy is just something that's cleaning the air, and it's making the air more breathable. And that's an immediate impact as well. In addition to, we know the long-term impacts are phasing out fossil fuels and ensuring that we're playing a leading role when it comes to fighting the climate emergency. But yeah, there's so much potential. You know, other countries, Denmark, we know is leading the way. We know there's so much potential in countries like Spain and Portugal and the Netherlands and Germany.
And anything else you'd like to add to what you said?
Well, I think the cost is too high for for us to not act. We must act. We know that 1.5 degrees. I remember being there when the Paris Climate Agreement was signed, and I remember there were folks there from Pacific Climate Nations that were saying that this is something that is not negotiable. That their lives, their countries are not negotiable. We're seeing waters rise. We're seeing entire villages in Fiji are being uprooted and relocated. We're seeing, smaller island nations having to plan for forced migration if the seas continue to rise. So, 1.5 is what's needed for so many people to survive. And it's really, really important to ensure that we are recognizing that this path that we're on is not the right path. And it's really important to make the changes to ensure that we fall into line with what science demands and recognize that this is life or death for everyone.
Hopefully, we will see a leap in consciousness soon on that issue.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. We need a fossil fuel phase out now. We know that this industry is just not compatible with a safe climate that we all deserve.
That's 350.org Canada Country Manager Atiyah Jafar speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. For KABU News in Depth, I'm Dave Johnson.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public.